You're listening to the Plain Label Podcast. Hello and welcome back to the Plain Label Podcast. I'm your host, Eric Williams. In this episode, we begin a two-part look at writer, director Yorgos Lanthimos and his films Dogtooth and The Lobster. Joining me for this episode is another first-time guest, Mr. Stephen Tronicek.
Hi, I'm happy to be here. I'm excited.
I'm excited as well. I'm excited as well because we'll talk about it when we get the actual discussion going, but I'm glad to have somebody that is very sort of keyed in or clued in on Mr. Lanthimos, because by myself, I would maybe struggle. So before we get into our discussion, I would like to mention that we are still proud members of the Deliberate Noise Network. Search Deliberate Noise in your podcast app for more great shows from the network. Stephen, what are you having to drink this evening?
I am not drinking any alcohol. I am, in fact, just drinking a very comfortable mug of chamomile tea right now. Uh-huh. Just enjoying that. We always drank it at my house when I was a kid, which was not very long ago. So I guess I'm still in the habit.
Gotcha. I'm having a local beer. It's something that I've had on a pretty regular basis, I guess. It's from here in Nebraska, but it is called Devil's Gap. It is a raspberry jalapeno ale.
Oh wow!
And so it's a little sweet at first, and then you get the sort of jalapeno kind of finish, and it's not bad. I think I actually prefer their regular one that's just the jalapeno ale, but that one's sort of tougher to talk and to enjoy at the same time. So that's what I'm going from. This one is from Kinkator, and they're local here in Nebraska.
I'll have to check that out.
Yeah, I'm not sure how wide their reach is. So I don't know if it gets to Missouri or not, but maybe it could be. So that's what we are drinking. Those are the two films that we're going to be discussing. We're of course going to go chronologically. And our first film, it is from 2009, and it is Dogtooth.
Ο αδερφός σας πέθανε. Ένα πλάσμα σαν αυτό που εισέβαλε σήμερα στον κήπο των Διαμέλης. Το ζώο που μας απειλεί λέγεται γάτα. Είναι το πιο επικίνδυνο ζώο που υπάρχει. Όσο βρίσκεστε μέσα, δεν κινδυνεύετε. Ένα παιδί είναι έτοιμο να φύγει από το σπίτι του όταν...
Πέσει ο δεξιός κινώδοντας.
Μόνο τότε ο οργανισμός είναι έτοιμος να αντιμετωπίσει όλους τους κινδύνους που παρέφυλανε. Παρ' όλα αυτά πρέπει να είμαστε προετοιμασμένοι. Θα σας αφήσω να πάρεις τίποτα.
And the IMDb plot synopsis for this one goes like this. Secluded from the rest of the world, confined to their affluent home and their high-walled front yard, three siblings, two sisters and one brother, are homeschooled by their parents, having no idea of life outside their prison. Within the family, the patriarch and his submissive wife give their offspring tape-recorded lessons which deliberately teach them the wrong meaning of words, further alienating them from reality. However, when the father introduces the son to Christina, a bad influence, and a woman who is hired to service him sexually, the frail equilibrium of things will be disrupted with unforeseen consequences. Okay, so Stephen, how would you rate that plot synopsis of Dogtooth?
Well, I think it definitely gets some really important aspects of the story in there. Mm-hmm. Some of the phrasing is good, patriarch especially. Mm-hmm. But I think the reading of Christina is actually completely incorrect in that yes. synopsis.
Yes.
Because the Lanthimos, something that is going to come up over and over and over again about Lanthimos as a writer and director, especially whenever he's working with his Greek co-writer Epthymis Philippou, is that he's telling stories that are thematic, allegorical stories. Like there's a societal framing to them. Mm. Often these stories are going to be about the interaction between a bourgeoisie class and a proletariat class, and how the bourgeoisie class manipulates the proletariat class. And in Dogtooth, what's interesting is that he has become a lot more like, over the course of his filmmaking, he's become a lot more open about like the way that he tells stories. Like he'll tell the audience more in something like The Favorite or The Killing of a Sacred Deer or The Lobster. But in Dogtooth, it feels like he's withholding, but he's still being extremely blunt to the point that it's kind of difficult not to get the message, which is, that's kind of his deal. It's difficult not to get the message.
Right. Yeah. it is interesting that he's on one hand, very heavy handed. And then on the other hand, it's very sort of like, what is the point ? You know, like what is the plot point of a lot of things? Like, I feel like I get more of the sort of messaging than I do what is he doing with the capital P plot? You know what I'm saying?
I find that really interesting because I'm only 21. And so I kind of grew up with these movies. Like The Lobster came out like my mid-teens or so. So I was kind of, it's kind of funny. I had to convince my mom that it was a much funnier movie than it actually was to get her to take me to see it. And she was so mad at me. Because I was laughing at it because I have a rather dark sense of humor. Mm-hmm. That being said, like having seen it this past time, I was a lot less, you know, a lot less humored by it. But she was so mad at me whenever we walked out of that.
Well, let's keep talking about that. What is your history with this? Like, when did you first see Dogtooth?
Well, Dogtooth I saw right after The Lobster.
Okay.
Because The Lobster was really what brought me into his work. Mm-hmm. And Dogtooth was rather disarming, mm-hmm. mainly because Dogtooth is his most, like, it's his most, if we're talking about content, it's his most disturbing film to me, at least.
Yeah, for sure.
Especially given the incest. The very, very dubious consensual like situations that the characters get into, especially a lot of the violence is a lot more on screen in mm-hmm. Dogtooth. And it's also the most abstract and allegorical of the pieces. Mm-hmm. So I think like a really important place to like pierce into Dogtooth is the fact that Lanthimos often is working, whenever he's working allegorical, he'll put stuff in the movie that doesn't need to necessarily make sense beyond the general allegory. I kind of inherited that as a storyteller. I love telling stories. It's about the vibe. Mm. Like, you know, you'll pick up on the different like allegorical pieces, and maybe it'll take a few times to kind of put together the plot of the piece, but the allegory reads true. And in Dogtooth, that allegory really comes down to the father acts as the bourgeoisie class who is affecting the proletariat, who are the children. And the bourgeoisie class is controlling the children's ability to comprehend language.
Mm-hmm.
So an important concept I think Lanthimos gets at in a lot of his films is the way is perception. Because those kids, you know, they're given the wrong ways of perception. They're given the wrong language. They can't actually perceive the world. They can't articulate situations.
Which isn't relevant to politics in 2021.
No, not at all. Not at all. It's not relevant at all. but But what I find interesting about, like, the main linchpin of Dogtooth is that the father tells the three children that they can't leave the compound unless their dog tooth or their canine tooth falls out.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, this leads to later in the film, the youngest sister knocking her two dog teeth out and planning an escape, the which of course the film leaves it ambiguous. But that moment of violence, that dog tooth moment of violence is really, it does kind of show you what you're in for with Lanthimos's work.
It's one of those horrible. Where, yeah, when you watch this film, like this was the first film that I saw of his. And I want to say it was something like, I want to say it was maybe like Film Spotting or some sort of film podcast where I had heard them discussing this film. And I'm old enough to where, you know, this was something where I was listening to podcasts when this came out, when this movie came out. And so I was like, okay, I'll check this out. Like, I have, you know, I don't have any sort of hang up about foreign films. I'll definitely check this out, especially because didn't this win for best foreign film?
It won at Cannes, if I remember correctly.
It was nominated for best foreign film. That's what it is.
People generally liked Dogtooth quite a bit.
Yeah, and so I was like, oh, okay, I'm an intellectual. I'm sure I'm going to like this. And I watched it the first time and just I was like shocked and appalled, and like sort of couldn't make heads or tails of it, but I also couldn't stop thinking about it. Right. Yeah. And so I was like, okay. And so I had watched it a couple of years after I had first seen it. And so then this is the third time that I saw it. And each time, I mean, it's no less disturbing because, you know, I forget the amount of sex that's in the movie. I forget the amount of like, like very, the egregious nudity that's in it. And I'm like, holy shit. Like,
yeah.
Like I'm no,
especially
prude, but I'm like, wow.
How awkward often those sexual encounters are.
Mm-hmm.
Cause that brings up a really important part of the allegory to the film to me, which is the character of Christina. Which I feel the character of Christina is mischaracterized in that synopsis because I don't feel she is like the thing that triggers the events of the story. I feel like she's still all most of the time part of the father's plan in the story. I think the thing that triggers the story is the airplane. That initial like breaking of the outside world, like an airplane flies over them and they mm-hmm. see it. And it's like, wait a second. And then as the story goes on, you know, the younger daughter starts to kind of figure out that maybe dad's full of shit.
Mm-hmm.
But Christina's character is very interesting to me as a thematic character because I feel because of the way that Lanthimos chooses to frame her and clothe her, costume her specifically, she's costumed as a security guard.
Yeah, I was going to say security, right? Because isn't, so, that's really interesting, right? Because she is the sort of almost like the police of what should be allowed to the kids.
Yep. Yeah. I feel like, you know, her being used as a sex object initially for the son in the film is a representation of like the proletariat that is being like, it's how the police control the proletariat, you know, it's mm-hmm. still like tied to the father's manipulation, like that bigger class manipulation, but the police is controlling the son. Christina is controlling the son. But what becomes interesting is that as the film goes on, Christina actually, she gains a bit more agency, but I don't feel like that disconnects her from like the bourgeoisie class character as she is. Because, I mean, I don't know about you, but I'm very much of the opinion that like, you know, the police are a dangerous force that needs to be disbanded and something new needs to be built. And I feel like Lanthimos is too, if you read this movie, but Christina, she takes on a mind of her own and she really starts to, she starts to sexually manipulate some of the children.
Mm-hmm.
And they're kind of grown adults, but it is still incredibly disturbing because they don't have context for the sexual acts that they're taking part in with Christina. Mm-hmm. And I feel like it's just an extrapolation of this this police force once it like kind of reaches a moment wherever the one part of the like the proletariat, which is the sun, kind of denies it. It goes and manipulates the other one, and it manipulates the other one through the trading of you know material
sparkly,
objects.
Yeah, the sparkly headband. Yeah,
the sparkly headband. Which I mean, I knowing Lanthimos and how he's like use his stories to tell like larger societal stories. Yeah, I think really the key to Christina is that security outfit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like that. What did you make of when because I think some of the things that he likes to play around with too is sexuality and not just who is having sex and when, but it seems like there's a suggestion at least that the son might be homosexual because mm-hmm. where you know he's like, oh, I prefer it the other way, and then she's on all fours instead of in a traditional sex position, I guess. And so I was like, oh, okay. So does that mean that, you know, but then I didn't know how he would have got the context of what that would have been or meant, or, you know, because he doesn't have any outside contact with anybody. But I just thought that that was something that was kind of interesting. And he touches on it again in Lobster when they ask about if he wants to be, because he can't be bisexual anymore. So does he want to be heterosexual or homosexual? So I just think that he has these little sort of just sort of touches that he puts in there that may not be the primary focus, but it's just like is weaved into the cloth of a Yorgos Lanthimos sort of film.
Right, you know? Right. I think it's really representative of exactly what is going on in The Lobster, which is that that there is a demonization within that household of, you know, homosexuality as a thing. There's definitely, and it even goes so far as at whenever Christina is no longer in the picture, the father requests that the son, you know, rape one of his sisters, which is just, that's really the worst scene of the movie. That's rough.
And what's upsetting about that too is not only is it like, here's what you're going to do, but they like put a bunch of makeup on her and straighten her hair. And you're like, oh no. Like, oh yeah. Boy.
And I think Lanthimos is really bluntly saying there that this patriarchal, this like very masculine way of control and power is essentially just going to turn into incest. It's going to turn into society being incestuous and a disaster and pretty horrible. No, I don't think I don't think that's without revolution, well, kind of quiet revolution, you know, the daughter does knock her dog teeth out. Mm-hmm. I think there is a suggestion that there will be a level of violence in that revolution because the daughter does knock her dog teeth out, mm-hmm. And then hide in the trunk. But you know, whenever the daughter is raped by the son, that scene ends with her saying, "If you ever do that again, I'll cut your balls off. I'll cut I'll cut everything off down there." And I think that there is like a moment of her, you know, fighting back a little there, even if. I mean, it's disturbing and it's a lot. And there's a question whether or not he needs to use such, you know, such abrasive content to pull off what he's doing. I think Dogtooth earns it mainly because it is so smartly constructed and it is so pulled back for the most part, at least in a visual style. Much of the film is shot in these beautiful long takes. Like most scenes are just one shot where the camera will push in on double and triple framing. That really, you know, pulls you into both these like weird objective yet weirdly subjective moments. Like the camera is objectively watching things, but you pick up on these subjective moments as it pushes into somebody's close up, which Bong Joon-ho does that a lot in Parasite as well, and in general. You'll also notice that a lot in the work of Steven Spielberg, where these long master shots.
Yeah. Well, and I think that what makes those longer shots work here is you have such uncomfortable subject matter, you have such uncomfortable scenes, even in something that at first plays so comedic, like the girls dancing.
Yeah.
To where you're like, oh, look how silly, oh, this is funny. And then after a while, you're like, oh, God, get this off the screen. You know, I'm sitting there and I'm writing down like, oh, please cut away, because I'm just feeling so uncomfortable by that moment.
Yeah, I love that he tends to just wallow in awkwardness.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely.
And on top of that, I think that those longer shots, they are really good at exemplifying a visual motif that pops up in all of his films. Mm. Now, it's more specifically, there is a delineation. I think that Killing of a Sacred Deer and The Favorite are different than this, but the same framing of the motif is in all four films. But he tends, in The Lobster and Dogtooth, he tends to frame figures that are stand-ins for violent power structures, i.e. the father, or sometimes Christina, or even the mother. And then in The Lobster, he frames the violent power structures. He tends to frame them off-screen. Lets scenes play out, hiding them off-screen. You'll notice whenever Christina is first introduced, she's introduced sitting in a car with a blindfold, with lots of negative space going off onto the right side of the frame, and we don't see the father, but he's having a conversation with her, and we're hiding him away from us. And I feel like he does that because he wants to convey the fact that these violent power structures, they don't want to be seen.
Mm-hmm. Controlling from a distance, yeah.
Right, and that's of course seen in the way that the father is giving them this language. You know, he's controlling from a distance. There's that barrier of language. He's giving them a barrier, the inability to cross that barrier of language to understand reality, which, you know, could be looked at as an allegory for propaganda. Mm-hmm. It could be looked at as an allegory for, you know, just putting up the blinders on people and like different systems that keep people in, you know, low paying jobs and stuff like that. It's a really broad allegorical movie.
Yeah. Well, and some of what I really liked was when one of the things that I put in here is one of the things I don't love about Lanthimos is I don't love the treatment of animals all the time. Cause I'm like, oh,
yeah,
God. Like, come on, like take it easy on the cat in this one and in the dog in the next one. And I'm like, can you just take it easy on the pets a little bit? But it's when the kids come across that cat, and then he's got to create this whole construct of this cat and what it did to this non-existent brother, and how you know, he's just got to create this lie. And then it's one of the, I'm sure for him, one of the prouder moments for him when the younger daughter, she regurgitates that lie later on. Mm-hmm. And she smashes the son's knee with a hammer or whatever, and then she says, oh, it was the cat, I saw the cat, you know, the cat did it, and that sort of thing. So it's like, that definitely strikes as a ruling class over your subjects and just regurgitating the lie sort of a thing.
Well, what I find funny is that I think that's a moment where he has to like take an oh shit moment, because I feel like that's a moment where he realizes that the daughter is having a little bit of agency and using it against him. And he has to like kind of figure out, how do I get around this? Because the daughter has just like harmed the son, who I do feel the father thinks is like the most important of the children, given that he's a boy.
Yeah, because he's got that patriarchy, right?
We got that patriarchy thing going on.
Well, that's one of the other things that I wanted to mention was how what a terrible light he puts this mother in.
Yeah.
because man, is she, I mean, the father is controlling and he's crazy. And you see plenty of movies where you have this one guy and he's insane and he's trying to control whatever. But to have this mother going along with it and then obviously disturbed by parts of it, that was the thing where it's like, oh, look at what a weak sort of light he puts the matriarchy in. Like, it doesn't, you know, you can have your feelings and you can have your sort of wants and this sort of thing, but that doesn't matter because this is a, you know, this is a man's world sort of, is the perspective that it feels like in this movie.
Yeah, absolutely. And I actually would have, I kind of took that also as there's a lot of writing on Bong Joon-ho's Snowpiercer where they talk about the train scene where they're the kind of the middle class of the train, mm-hmm. And how they're like educated about the back of the train and the front of the train. And I feel like the mother is kind of like the middle class where she has enough information to know that she's disadvantaging the kids, mm-hmm. and she's choosing to do so, but she is also has like the education within the context of the world to understand, like, just to understand the forces at play. And I find that really interesting about her character, that there's a choice to do that. Mm-hmm. It's disturbing because she has access to the phone. Like, yep, she can still call outside of reality. She can like see outside of the system, but she still has the power to, you know, manipulate and keep the blinders on these kids. And speaking of like blinders of the kids, the film is shot anamorphic, which is different than The Lobster. I think The Lobster is shot on spherical lenses for the most part. A definition of those anamorphic lenses that they're shooting on is the anamorphic leaves that distortion on the lens. And there's these really weird close-ups in this mm-hmm, movie mm-hmm. Where the image bows around the characters, where these kids, you know, you can see the blinders just baked into the frame. And because he shoots with so much negative space, you know, you really get the sense that this this world is warped. Mm-hmm. And on top of that, if we're talking about formal elements, the look of it really reminds me of Haneke. Was a lot of his color films. And Lanthimos, as a director, often reminds me of Haneke because he's dealing with violence and societal structures, and he's dealing with it in Lanthimos is less cold than Haneke is about it. Like, Sacred Deer has a sense of humor, and The Favorite has a sense of humor, and The Lobster has a sense of humor. I don't know if Dogtooth technically has a sense of humor.
Well, I mean, there is the dance scene.
Yeah, the dance scene.
And then there is her impression of Rocky and Apollo Creed. That's pretty good.
I mean, like, I mainly laugh at Dogtooth in awkwardness.
Oh, for where sure.
We're just holding on things too long. Mm-hmm. And it's just, it's so messed up most of the time. But what's strange is that a lot of the violence happens off screen in Dogtooth. Mm-hmm. The choice,
or it happens so quickly that you see what it is, like when she cuts the brother's arm fairly early on,
right? Or when the cat is killed, it mm-hmm. happens off screen, which on one hand that's just convenient, you know, you're shooting a movie really fast, you have to shoot the cat off screen, but I also feel like there's an effort to hide or paste over the violence, like the physical violence that happens in the movie. Mm-hmm. Even until the ending, of course.
Oh, for sure, yeah. Well, and he thankfully does that in the next film too, especially with one of the more potentially gruesome scenes.
Though I'd argue that that violence doesn't happen in the next film, but we'll get there. What interests me with the cat is the way that Lanthimos is, because he's attacking this from a societal range, I think that the way that he deals with animals comes from his connection of humans as animals, mm. as humans as a natural thing. I tend to really enjoy movies and directors whose philosophies kind of go towards that this capitalistic, you know, growing world is an evil thing, and we need to break it down and kind of go back to something that is a little more natural. I mean, there's a lot of co-option that can be done there, and Lanthimos certainly explores that type of co-option in a lot of his movies. But I love Terrence Malick films, and I think that Lanthimos is doing a similar thing to Malick, much less gracefully, let's say, in that he definitely is tying humans to animals, which is very explicit in The Lobster and very explicit here even. You know, the kids are looked at as dogs. They're looked as trained things. And I think he's just saying whenever a human kills an animal, he's killing a human. He's killing something that has a soul and something that is like, you know, a natural element of the world. And what he's really trying to do is show that society kills a lot of things, or at least these imposed social like boundaries kill a lot of things.
Hmm. Yeah, I like that. I like that. What about what did you find with the use of music in his work? Like, is that something that's because that's something that I feel like is one of the areas that he's a little more muted, at least in this version, at least in this discussion compared to his later two films that we'll be discussing, to where he doesn't seem like he uses it too often here, to where there's, you know, a little bit of background noise here and there, and then there's obviously the performance scene that we mentioned, but it's you know, it's not like a main focus of his. It doesn't feel like to me.
Well, I think it really comes down to the beat of scenes. I've watched him in interviews talk about whenever he released Sacred Deer, he talked about at the Cannes conference, I think. He talked about how he'd often felt really uncomfortable putting music in his movies. And I think it's because he just wants to maintain the awkward atmosphere. He wants to maintain that hypnotic, like lean the audience in atmosphere, and he felt like the music would break it. I think the music is especially integral to Sacred Deer, but we'll get there. In this film, I feel like the music the score is very sparse. There's hardly any score, and whenever he does use soundtrack, it's another allegorical device. You know, the father is mistranslating "Fly Me to the Moon" to them. the daughter is dancing to this like weird music, and you get that in his film that followed Dogtooth, which is called Alps.
Right,
his weakest film in my estimation, I mainly find it the weakest because he just pulls back too much, and it does feel a bit like a retread of some of the stuff that he's doing in Dogtooth. But music is quite a big allegorical aspect in Alps. You know, the dancer who wants to do, you know, dancing to pop music, who can't do dancing to pop music because her coach tells her she can't. Which that dancer is played by a rather important figure within Lanthimos's work, which I think we'll get more into her in The Lobster, but it's Ariana Labed, who is his wife. If I remember correctly, he met her on the set of a film called Attenberg, which is a great Greek film and really feels like a precursor to Lanthimos's films. It's another allegorical film that deals a lot with relationships and societal relationships, and deals a lot with like appropriating humans as animals. And Lanthimos is actually Ariana Labed's love interest in that film. He's an actor, and it's really funny to watch him like act like a Lanthimos character in another Greek filmmaker's film. Especially since he seems to have taken a lot of cues from Attenberg, the direction of Attenberg in his own work.
Yeah, I'm looking at it now. It's interesting that it came out the year after Dogtooth. I guess I would have assumed that it came out before, he started out as an actor and then transitioned.
Maybe I made that assumption.
But he plays the engineer, it looks like, here. And yeah, interesting. I'll have to check that out and see if I can find that.
It's excellent. It's really funny. Annenberg is much more outwardly funny than Dogtooth is.
a high bar, to be sure.
Yes. I do want to mention a quick thing about the violence in the film, which is that sources of media are used to inflict violence in this film.
That's very interesting. Often. Yeah.
The father beats the youngest daughter with a videotape and mm-hmm. then does the same thing to Christina with a VHS player. Mm-hmm. He beats them to death with this source of media, i.e. the ruling class is using media to beat these people to death, right. or at least inoculate them. I think that this is then contested with these very quiet revolutionary actions by the younger daughter. I think, you know, the way that she speaks to her father changes over the course of the film. Mm-hmm. Obviously, the hammer hit feels like, I'm going to damage your prize and see what happens. And he kind of has to like go back and say, oh shit, like, okay, yeah, I guess the cat did come in here and do it. Like, that's how I read that, where he's like, I guess he did, you son of a bitch.
Yeah, really. Yep. Yeah, I wonder where is that in terms of where's the hammer and the cat in terms of the fish scene where he releases the fish? Because I always thought that, as I guess I think of it now, as he felt like he needed to regain some control at one point. Yeah. And so he introduces those fish, and then it's like, oh well, I'm the only one who can, you know, use the harpoon gun or whatever it is that he actually is using there. And that was the thing where it's like, look how sad and pathetic this man actually is when he has to do something physical, because he's like old man jumping into the pool, and he's got his little little kid snorkel looking thing. And I'm like, God, what a sorry sack this guy actually is. Like, you know, he's not any actual physical threat to these three, except for his shocking sort of violence and their willingness to take it, you know.
I think Lanthimos, as much as he displays the power of these patriarchal, very capitalistic coded systems, which are people within his films, I think he is very, very, he makes an effort to show you that they are all miserable and pathetic. Mm. That is mm-hmm. really, really the case in Sacred Deer, which is my favorite of the four films. And Sacred Deer is very funny in that way because of the amount of piss take shots that are in Sacred Deer, and there's a lot of piss take shots in Dogtooth, where the dad is presented with a situation that completely undermines his stuff, and he just has to look at it and just mm-hmm. stare at it and mm-hmm. be like, oh no, what have I done? That especially comes whenever the daughter, in the scene, whenever the daughter says that the cat attacked the brother, yep. because he frames that so wide, and the dad's reaction is he just stands there like,
Exactly, yeah, exactly.
I think that it really comes to a fruition whenever he does ask the one of the daughters, he does make the decision to have one of the daughters, you know, fulfill the sexual role for the son. Because mm-hmm. I think that's pretty much his most pathetic act in the entire movie. Mm-hmm. How he is so integrated into this way of thinking, this way of seeing the world, that he would make such a horrifying choice and mm-hmm. let it happen. I think that's the most pathetic he gets. And of course, you know, at the ending, he is just running around, just trying to find the daughter who he thinks has escaped. And he gets into the car and he starts the car at the ending of the movie. And it's like, you are going to let her out. That's what's going to happen. You dumb. You are so stupid. I think that's why I'm kind of tolerable of some of the more horrible things in Dogtooth, because it is so deliberately about how these power structures control us, but also how miserable that is. Mm-hmm. And I, as a filmmaker and as a screenwriter and as, you know, a film critic, I often really am adamant about films earning their content. Like, I'm really not a fan of Gaspar Noé because I don't think he earns the violence and the amount of, you know, disturbing content he puts on screen. Mm-hmm. I think that his films are thematically empty. And I think Lanthimos, why I'm so attuned to him and why I love his work is that he really earns it. Mm-hmm. He takes the time to write this the way that it needs to be written. He takes the time to infuse these stories with such thematic weight that you really get why all of this is happening and how it like clicks together. Yeah. And
well, and I think one of the more base things that's important to say, you know, in case people either are needing their memories jogged or what have you, or haven't seen the film and are just, you know, experiencing through our discussion, is that he doesn't give you the sort of really cheap and easy, the opening of the trunk at the end.
Yeah.
Right. Because you don't, I mean, because the amount of blood that she loses, you're like, well, I mean, she's alive, right? But she's not getting out, you know? And so it's like, well, she's not getting out. So is she waiting? Is she dead? Like what's going on in that trunk? And so I think that I think that she's just in there waiting to escape, just like how I think he's hoping that the sort of ruling class doesn't stay that way. But I think it's a lot easier to be, to sort of coddle the audience by having like a click of the trunk at the end of the film or something. But I think that would also kind of ruin it. And so I'm glad that he doesn't do it, but I also think that that's what an audience wants, you know?
I think Lanthimos believes too strongly in the fact that humans will do stupid stuff and that people will make stupid mistakes. You know, it's like that Greek tragedy, which again, we'll get into that with Sacred Deer, like, because Sacred Deer is like specifically like drawn from partly from a Greek tragedy. But, you know, he's so attuned to that specific moralistic architecture that like, I don't think he wants to give you this easy, happy ending. And the lobster acts the same way, mm-hmm. where whether or not he leaves her in that diner, we do not know.
Right.
And it is messed up whether or not he just leaves her there. And I think it's just to say humans will make the same folly over and over again. And, you know, admittedly, I think Sacred Deer is the one film in all of these films, because The Favorite does end rather ambiguously as well, that really has any sort of restorative justice put upon it. Now, whether or not that justice is pretty is another question, but it's definitely an integral part of his worldview.
Yeah. I think that's exactly right. Well, anything else about Dogtooth? Like anything that is in your notes that we skipped or forgot to mention before we move on to our second film?
There's a line in the film that is a very funny play on words, which I think Eptimus Philippou and Yorgos Lanthimos, whenever they write these films, they're very dry movies. There's a lot of cleverness just hidden on the surface. And it's a pussy is a big light. When a pussy is switched off, the room goes dark. Mm. I'm like, oh God,
because the son, what's that word? Or the daughter asks what that word means.
Right.
She sees it on the VHS, on the porn.
It does feel like, a signifier within the language that there needs to be a feminine presence in this world. Mm-hmm. That is the big light that needs to be switched on. Cause the room has gone dark at that point. It's kind of a funny play on words in that context, but also, yeah, it really is the father, like just making a really, really brutal mistranslation for his kids. that Absolutely. Furthermore manipulates them.
Yeah, so this is one that I'll say that I appreciate the film we're about to discuss more, to where I feel like for me, and maybe this is just something that it's a translation issue comparatively. Like maybe that's the thing that sort of is a barrier that holds me back a little bit more, or I don't know, maybe it's the incest stuff that maybe yes. holds me back a little bit.
Yeah.
but so I enjoy Dogtooth. It's not one that I think that I will, you know, unless I'm looking it up for a specific reason, it's not one that I'll just kick on and be like, hey, 12-year-old and wife, let's just watch this.
Let's just watch that thing. Whenever I first saw both films, I definitely had a greater appreciation for The Lobster. It might have been, you know, recency bias because because I saw The Lobster first, and it was my first, you know, it was my first foot in the pool of Yorgos Lanthimos, and I was like 15 years old and really getting into movies and really getting into like how to tell stories and theme, and you know, and The Lobster is a great film to teach theme and storytelling out of, because, and any of his films are, because he basically realizes that if you are telling a story that is all allegory, you can get away with anything. And that's what I love about his films. If you're telling a story that takes place in a completely allegorical space, who cares whether or not it makes a lick of sense? As long as it's dramatically compelling and it fits the theme and the allegory, you're good. Mm-hmm. And I mean, that's something that I have adopted into my work, which is why my work will never be produced.
What did I tell you? It was after you sent me the log line to his latest Emma Stone. I was like, he must be really good in the room, right? Like he must be such a salesman, because on the page, you're like, no way is this going to work.
Well, and I think part of it is that the screenplays are actually all very good. Mm. Sacred Deer won Best Screenplay at the Cannes Film Festival. It's a good script. It knows exactly what it's doing. And I think The Lobster is very much the same way. It's a great script. And it's a script that has some really interesting ideas going into it, especially whenever it comes to how, again, how humans relate to the natural world, sure. How this romantic, you know, entanglement that they impose is a unnatural thing. This is the film where people are most closely tied to animals, because, right. you know, it's a movie about, if you're not in a couple, you get sent to a hotel and in 30 days you get turned into an animal.
That's exactly
and
right, yeah.
Good luck, go right. find a couple.
That's right. Well, let's back up the listening audience just a bit. So our second film is the aforementioned Lobster, and is from 2015.
Have you ever been on your own before?
No, never.
Your last relationship lasted how many years?
Around 12.
Sexual preference?
Women. Is there a bisexual option available?
No, sir. This option is no longer available. And the dog?
My brother. He was here a couple of years ago, but he didn't make it.
Did you read the leaflet?
Yes, I did.
As you understand from your brother's experience,
if you fail to fall in love with someone during your stay here, you'll turn into an animal.
Have you ever danced with anybody?
Yes.
As an animal, you'll have a second chance to find a companion.
What sort of dancing did you do?
Just depends on the music.
Mind if I join you?
It's no coincidence that the targets are shaped like single people and not couples.
Τον καιρό που μ' αγαπούσες, με ρωτάς ένα πρωί.
Did you catch rabbits? Catching a rabbit is difficult.
Thank you very much.
If you need more rabbits, I'll bring you more.
You promise?
Τότε γύρισα και σου είπα.
You can be a loner as long as you like. There is no time limit. Any romantic or sexual relations are punished.
Μα για μένα.
We have to be totally synchronized. 3, 2.
You're like a brother to me. Oh, you're my best friend in the whole world.
I don't think I'm your best friend in the whole world.
Now, have you thought of what animal you'd like to be if you end up alone?
Yes, a lobster.
A lobster is an excellent choice. If you encounter any problems, you cannot resolve yourselves, you will be assigned children. That usually helps.
And the IMDb plot synopsis for the film is an interesting one, and it goes like this. Set in a dystopian future, single people are sent to a hotel where they must find a partner in 45 days or get turned into a wild animal of their choice. David's wife has just left him after 11 years of marriage, and he is sent, it says, and he is sent the hotel. Okay. His chosen animal, should he not find a partner, is a lobster, period. And that's it. I love it. Oh, IMDb, you never fail to disappoint.
I think that that's a good, like, you know, it's a good log line. It's a good starting point. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it just occurred to me that with all the Jordan Peterson people as lobsters, this movie has just gotten funnier as time goes on.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. One of the things that was just, so this was the first watch for me. This time around. And so this was the one that I had yet to see of these four. And so I was really blown away. Like, I thought that this was quite good. It was everything that I had seen about it was mostly the first half hour or so.
Uh-huh.
And so once Rachel Weisz finally shows up, because after a while I was like, is she just going to be the narrator? Like, what's going on? Like, where is she at? And then we have Lea Seydoux, and I'm like, well, wait a minute. Is she the love interest or what is happening here? And we got that whole last hour that was much different than what I'd been led to believe by the trailers that this film was really sort of taking on, because I was still loving the first half. It was just a completely different experience from the second half. But some of the things that I wrote down early was just like the absolute absurdity of the registering at this place just had me rolling. Like, I just thought it was so funny and so good. And I could just imagine how good, like you said, this is on the page, right? Like it's just got to be such a specific tone on the page to be, and I guess it helps if you're adapting your own work, but because I can't imagine this being in the hands of somebody else, and they'd look at it like, what? Like, what am I doing with this? You know, so it's I don't know. I really enjoyed the film. I think I put down like a 4.5 or something like that out of 5. I thought I was surprised because I didn't realize, you know, some characters, like, I didn't even realize John C. Reilly was in the movie.
Yeah, and he's great. He's
good.
And John C. Reilly is an extremely talented comic actor. Like, he is one of the funniest guys in movies right now. And I wish he was in more like weird, funny movies like this, because he's got a sensitivity to him that that maybe Colin Farrell doesn't.
Yeah.
And man, like, just to go to Colin Farrell, I think like Colin Farrell's like resurgence into indie film is like, it feels like it starts here. It feels like it really starts, for me at least, here in The Lobster, where he's so excellently like in tune with what Yorgos is doing, and he's so funny. He looks so pathetic.
Oh, it looks awful.
His glasses and his mustache.
He is just so unhappy in this movie.
Farrell's always been a much better character actor than he has been in like bigger movies. And there was a period whenever he, I see him in interviews and he talks about how he enjoys doing the small movies because the big movies just, they just take everything out of him. And
you're trying to tell me that the remake of Total Recall was no good, or?
What
about when he was the villain in the
Alexander? What about when he was Alexander?
Or the first attempt at the Daredevil movie.
The Daredevil thing, yeah.
Oh, brother.
Man. Oh man. You know, Farrell is one of those actors who I think is so, so incredibly versatile. He's one of the actors that I can see on my, he's basically at the top of the list of actors that I'd love to work with sometime. It's that guy and maybe like John Hamm, just because I'm really obsessed with Mad Men. He does seem
like a guy that's like an all in kind of guy.
Yeah.
Right. Like whatever you ask of him, he's got like some Nick Cage in him in that respect. It's like, yeah, I'll fucking go for it. Like you tell me whatever you want me to do, I'm there.
to do the scene in Sacred Deer where he shows Barry Keoghan the body hair, you kind of have to be, all in. But so with the lobster, I think that what's really important as far as the lobster in like making you believe everything in the story is that he frames the mise-en-scene like a Greek tragedy, in that we have a narrator. We know that there's going to be a figure in this that is telling us a story. You know, she talks in the past tense about the events that happened here.
Well, and yeah, she does, but then she gets caught up.
Right.
Right. Right. It's all this. And then I met him, or then he figured out I was also short-sighted, I think is what they call it. Right.
Which I mean, that kind of brings us to like the way that the film is literally about imposing boundaries. Mm-hmm. You know, the narrator imposes boundaries on where the story is going to go. The society imposes boundaries that you should have a similar thing in common to fall in love. Like you have to be short-sighted, or Ben Whishaw's character bashes his face against stuff to get a nosebleed so that he can hook up with the nosebleed girl, who's played by
Jessica Borden.
I remember Jessica Borden. Yeah. She's great. I love her in almost everything I've seen her in. And yet I actually think The Lobster is one of his most sincere films because of the Jessica Borden character. Mm-hmm. There's this great subplot that's going on between her and her blonde counterpart. You know, her friend's aspect, like what differentiates her like characteristic, to say the least, is that she has beautiful hair.
Oh yeah, the good hair and a nice chest is what she says.
Good hair and nice chest, right? And there's this wonderful moment whenever the nosebleed girl, who's Jessica Borden, she sits down with the girl on the last day that girl is there.
Oh yeah,
and she reads her this letter, and I feel like what the blonde hair woman is anticipating at that moment is kind of a confession of love. Honestly, I feel like the blonde haired woman is in love with her. And there's a great melodrama to that scene because, you know, the nosebleed woman, what she just is very cold and says, I'm glad that we had this friendship and blah, 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 blah. And then the blonde haired woman just smacks her.
Well,
she's like,
yeah, I
thought this explosion.
Right. I thought that was like the nosebleed woman. And for people that are wondering, like, that's her character name.
Yeah.
It's not just what we're calling her.
That's her characteristic. Like, right. You know, Ben Whishaw is the limping man and John C. Reilly is the stuttering man.
Right. Yeah. And so what she does is she has this, like she has this goodbye note that I was so like, I was eating it up in the moment, but I was also sort of off put by, because it's like in Twitter terms, it's such a humble brag, right? Like she's saying, well, when I go off to the yacht, or when I get basically when Ben Whishaw and I go to this thing, or when we have this child that we've been given or whatever. And I'm like, God, shut up. Like, it's not about you. Like, you're not the one who's getting turned into the pony. Right. It's your friend. And so I don't know, that was the thing where I was like, good, get her, like get her. Yeah.
Well, I agree. I think she's extremely insensitive in that moment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you know, I think one thing to like, one really big thing to highlight in The Lobster is, of course, this concept that that people have to be in a relationship or they're turned into animals. Mm-hmm. Which, I mean, once you say that out loud, you kind of get the basics, which is, oh, you're an animal if you're not in a relationship. but it does, you know, suggest Lanthimos's making humans as animals, or tying animals to the human experience. Because, you know, the sacred deer in Sacred Deer is the sun, and the bunnies in The Favorite are stand-ins for children of Queen Anne. So that becomes like such an important part, especially since his brother is the dog, who is unfortunately killed by the Heartless Woman whenever Colin Farrell attempts to convince the Heartless Woman that he is in fact also heartless, which something funny, I didn't realize that the Heartless Woman was the youngest daughter in Dogtooth, or one of the daughters in Dogtooth, because she looks so different.
Yeah, she's the older daughter that knocks her teeth
right
out. Yeah.
Yeah, she looks so different.
Yes, she does.
The Lobster. But the Heartless Woman situation, it presents a really interesting idea of people imposing behaviors in order to stay in relationships. Which that of course pops up with Ben Whishaw's his bleeding nose, where he triggers a bleeding nose to be with the nosebleed woman. But Colin Farrell imposes this heartlessness, which happens in quite a funny scene wherever the Heartless Woman pretends to choke and die.
Yes.
And Colin Farrell has to pretend not to notice. Which, of course, you know, the first time he proposes that the Heartless Woman and him hang out, it's whenever the woman who is real, the biscuit woman, who's the most sincere character in the movie to me, because she's so desperate to, you know, get with, she's so desperate to get with somebody. I mean, she really wants to.
She is,
and then
so
she throws
hard.
Herself off.
She is so hard to take. Like, she is just so hard to watch.
Yeah, it's such a sad thing, because it's like, you can see this person truly suffering under this imposition of ideals, but she just can't take it, and she commits suicide. And I think like the elements of self-harm are really close to Lanthimos's movies, because like in itself, the sociological imposition of these boundaries is harming ourselves. And that becomes really, really relevant in Sacred Deer and The Favorite as well.
Yeah.
And is like pretty blatant in The Lobster, because Ben Whishaw, you know, he harms himself to be part of the nosebleed
right?
relationship.
Yeah.
And it's a lot, but again, I think the film is so wickedly and so incredibly constructed that he kind of gets away with it. He gets away with all of this really abrasive content. I think one thing that's important too is the way that he frames the body in The Lobster. You know, people are in various states of undress for most of the film, or they're completely covered up. He treats the body as a grotesque thing. And there's like grotesqueries in quotation marks everywhere, you know, like, of course, the woman whose nose bleeds all the time, or the limping man, or the stutter, there's a problematic like road to go down with that. But it is interesting, even the way that Colin Farrell carries himself, you know, that kind of slunched over, you know, pathetic look. It's really baked in.
And even when they do play with some sexuality, it's not titillating in the least. Like when it's when the woman like sits and grinds on him for a while, and then she's like, "Oh, you got an erection earlier than you did yesterday," or whatever.
Which that woman is Ariane Labed. That's Lanthimos' wife.
Oh, okay. Awesome.
The nurse is Lanthimos' wife.
Oh, the maid. Yeah, there it is, yeah.
Yeah, the maid. She starts to show up in his movies at this point because of Attenberg. You know, what's interesting is that in Attenberg, sexuality is treated very similarly, where it's kind of a commodity and kind of, very cold. In Attenberg, or very anxious. And I think it really comes down to those barriers that are applied. You know, there's no half sizes in shoes. Right. There's no room for interpretation. There's no bisexuality. Pick one.
Yep.
Which, you know, comes even into the larger, like the macro storytelling, which is you're either in a couple in the hotel or you are alone in the forest, which, you know, becomes... Which it's just that imposition, and it's about how stupid all of that is.
Right. Well, especially when they really push it to the limit once that they're in the group that has to be alone, right? Where they're the complete opposites, and then you see them doing something as simple as trying to go to the mall, and they're like, you know, they have to have their certificate, and that one woman's getting checked out to see if she has dirt under her fingernails, and they're really sort of analyzing, like, are you really in a couple? Are you just pretending? And just to have it be a government regulation, it was just like, oh my God, like what? It was one of those where conceptually it felt like a completely different movie from the whole this person's gonna turn into a lobster, right? To where it was more about like government oppression and that sort of thing. But I was like, okay, well, this is taking a complete right turn, but I'm all the way in for this is also. So
yeah, if there's one complaint that I would have with the lobster, it's that it does feel a bit truncated into two acts. And that's fine. Like the event, the midpoint that sends him into the forest is a great moment that I love where Lebed's maid character helps him take out the heartless woman that kind of twist. And then he drags her into the room and the narration says, I'm not going to tell you what goes on in there.
And then throughout the rest of the movie, they're like, I can't believe you did that to her.
Right. Which I think that there is the narration does a lot to kind of flatten the world and make it objective. It's another imposition where it's like you can have it or you can't have it. It's with or without. I think, you know, it's that type of construction from a script level, from a, you know, storytelling level, that really makes this as rock solid as it is.
Yeah. One of the things that I find interesting as a script reader is just like imagining the notes that I would give a typical, like a not well done version of this and of Dogtooth. Because I feel like I would just go on and on and on about, oh, you can't do this. Ooh, no, you can't do this. This doesn't fit this sort of formula. Or I don't know that you need this narrator. Why do you get caught up to the narrator halfway through? You know, I would just have all of these sort of quote unquote by the book notes to give to a spec screenplay such as this. And I feel like I would, you know, I would love to read these just to sort of see what it is that he does, like how he's able to put this much tone on the page. Because I think as a script, as a spec, I would be like, I don't know if you can do this. I don't know if you can pull this off. I would be worried, you know.
As a script reader myself, I agree with you. And I think it'd be really funny because there is some like, I mean, I feel like if I read this script, I would love the general vibe of it. And yet I would feel like, you know, you're still like kind of imposed to talk about how it isn't traditional and how there are a lot of like symbols and a lot of things like that, that I'm not sure about, like, is going to sell the script, which I mean, again, that's why my work is never going to be produced. It's because there is everything is very carefully thought out to the point that it feels like this. But it is not quite down that traditional path. You know, I think that speaking of symbols, they're everywhere. They're everywhere.
Absolutely.
You know, there's the handcuff, handcuffing the hand behind his back.
Yeah.
And you know what's funny about that is that the people don't consider the fact that he can use both of his hands if he just takes off his pants.
Well, yeah, because then he does take them off. it's just a willingness to handicap yourself, right? Just like a willingness to burden yourself and feel like you're oppressed because you're not with someone else.
And there's this willingness to accept the situation is really brought out in the first of all, the deadpan delivery of everything. Like, characters just take it and then keep going. But there's this great montage near about the middle of that first half of the film where they're doing these scenarios. The single man at dinner and he chokes and dies. The coupled man at dinner and the woman saves him, or the single woman walking home at night and the guy pretends to rape.
And see that's something to where I would see that and I'm like, nope, you can't put that in there.
You can't do that. Yep. And yet it works so well. Mm-hmm. And on one hand, I you gotta thank that editor. You gotta thank whoever edited the movie. Because the film is really it's constructed a lot like a later Paul Thomas Anderson movie to me, where the scenes that are like full scenes are swimming in this great thematic text of montage. Like, there's these great montage sequences, and then a great scene will happen, and then the montage sequence will happen, and it really helps dramatically keep the pace going of the movie. Mm-hmm. I see so many films where it's beautiful and it's austere, but the it's so deadpan and the pace never changes and it's not dramatically solvent. But in The Lobster, if we're talking about like story construction, you know, there's these great deadpan scenes and then there's these great montages that speed it up a little bit and keep it going, and it's just great story construction.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, some of the things, just looking at my notes here briefly, and most of it's stuff that we've already brought up, but I wanted to make sure and mention Olivia Colman, right, in this role, to where I'm like, brilliant. Good Lord, can this woman do everything or what?
She's so great in this role. And, mm-hmm. you know, I wanted to bring up the fact that her subplot within the film is really important.
Oh, yeah.
Because it's Lanthimos highlighting that the people in power are miserable and pathetic. Because mm-hmm. there's this wonderful montage where the loners break into the mansion and they give Olivia Colman's husband a pistol and they say, shoot her or we'll kill both of you. And he pulls the trigger and there's no bullets. And then they just leave. And it's like, live with that, asshole.
Well, yeah, because they leave with her bound still, right? Like, isn't right. she still, and so it's very much like a he better hope that she doesn't get free because she is not pleased.
Right. And it's that type of sense of humor that really makes The Lobster funny. It reminds me, I actually wrote a piece back in high school about how it reminds me of like the humor that Flaubert uses in Madame Bovary, where I don't know necessarily if Madame Bovary's death is supposed to be funny, where she takes the arsenic and she thinks she'll die very quietly and gracefully.
Yep.
And then it takes forever for her to die. And whenever we analyzed it, we kind of came to the conclusion it was supposed to be kind of funny and kind of ridiculous. And I feel like that's a good explanation of the humor in this film.
Oh, absolutely. It's not too dissimilar from the butter biscuit woman jumping from room like 138 or whatever it is instead of 400.
That's the part where my mom got really mad at me, because the detail of like her jumping from room 138 instead of room 400 had me rolling in the theater. Mm-hmm. And she just looked at me like I was a psychopath.
She's like, uh-oh, you have been revealed.
She's like, oh, I made some mistakes here along the way. But one of the great montage sequences is, of course, that initial hunting where the violence, the most explicit like form of violence is probably the blinding of Rachel Wise, or the cutting of people's lips, or the killing of his brother. But textually, the first like explicit view of violence is this hunting, where they go hunt the loners in the woods with guns. And I looked up the song that is playing during that sequence, because it's a beautifully orchestrated slow motion sequence that is so funny, because John C. Reilly is just stumbling over himself.
Oh, and he's got his hair just flopping everywhere. Yeah, his big curly hair is like brushed out, and he's just flopping everywhere.
And it's such a beautiful image whenever the Heartless Woman shoots her gun and you see that slow motion dart like flying through the woods. And what's his name? Jason Smiley. What's his name? This is a great character actor movie. Michael Smiley. This is a great character actor movie, by the way. There's like so many wonderful European and American character actors in this film. You know, that's just a beautiful image. But the song that is playing during that is, it's a Greek song that is about somebody considering whether or not their life is worth living now that the person who they loved is gone. And I'm like, well, that's pretty self-evident. Like, well, yeah.
Yeah, it is funny because, like we had mentioned, you may not always understand what the actual like A to B plot is going to be, but the message is always clear.
Yes. It really pops out. So I think that something that's notable in Dogtooth and The Lobster is the use of zooms, I think Yorgos Lanthimos owes a whole lot to Kubrick, that he is not quite he's actually very vocal about it. Like the in Killing of a Sacred Deer, the following shots in the hallway look exactly like the ones from The Shining.
Well, who doesn't owe to Kubrick anymore? You know, everybody's been raised on Kubrick, it seems like.
But you know, the movie are so like, so funny, but they're so menacing. It's like Jeff Nichols, whenever he's making Take Shelter, he talked about using zooms from The Shining as like something sneaking up on the characters.
Yeah.
And I think that that Lanthimos just uses that brilliantly here. As well as stuff like, you know, putting funny insert shots of like random animals just walking through the forest. There's a pig or an elephant.
That's right. Your pig is rooting for truffles. You got like a camel in the background or whatever, just kind of hanging out.
He's just enjoying the time. But you know, once he gets out to the loners, it becomes obvious that The Lobster is a film about how either extreme is bad. Because being alone is, and being punished for being alone is bad, and being in a couple and being punished for being in a couple is bad.
Yeah. it's always surprising to me when I see Lea Seydoux playing not like the damsel in distress, to where I'm like, God, why does she not get more opportunities like this? Because she is so good at playing cold. Like she just looks like she just doesn't care about anyone the entire film. And I think that it helps that, you know, they talked about how there was not a lot of makeup that was used in the film, to where everyone had like a natural look. And so I was like, well, that makes sense, because she just is, it's just a, I don't have time for any of these games. Like, you know, she's got her objective that she believes in as much as the father from Dogtooth does, you know, to where she has this the sort of game that she's playing. And I do love the scene where Rachel Weisz, once they're in love, are making out in front of her parents, and she absolutely loses it there. Like, I love how that sort of slow builds, and that's like as broad and comedic as we get outside of the dance sequence, after the celebration dance sequence.
Right, right.
That's another one where I was like, oh my God. Like,
what? It also calls back to that, like, we're going to just hold on this and let the awkwardness be funny from Dogtooth. But something that become, you know, I might be reading in here a little bit too much, but something that I always find so funny is that I always feel like the LeBeg nurse character is in love with Lea Seydoux as well.
Could be.
And they just look at each other so longingly, and she like just explains to her, today is my last day. Mm-hmm. I'm going to leave my husband. It's like, Lea Seydoux, just stop imposing this stuff. Mm-hmm. you're just making more problems for yourself.
Well, and again, I like that they give you the impression of, you know, like, it's pretty clear what's going to happen to her, but they don't detail what happens to her, right? Like, they put her in the grave.
She's gonna die horribly. I think Rachel Weisz, there's kind of a turn in her career here as well, because, you know, she was kind of, I don't want to say that her many of her roles are like objects or so within films, but she does seem like a plot device in a lot of films, you know, like The Fountain, and stuff like that, where she really doesn't shine as much and she's great in those films, don't get me wrong, but her characters don't always shine as much as those films. But here she's just so pronounced as an actress, and she's wonderful in this.
She really is, yeah.
That, of course, you know, extends out to The Favorite once we get there, where she is just throwing her weight around.
Absolutely.
And it's just fantastic. And the moment whenever she is blinded in this film, I remember that being the moment that I was like, oh, I'm going to get yelled at by my mom whenever we were walking out, because I was like, oh man, this is getting dark to the point that she's gonna be mad.
Yeah, well, it was one of those things to where the most terrifying aspect of it was not the different hunting down the people that you're close with, or the woman that jumps off the part of the castle. It's that medical scene.
Right.
And as of recording, our next episode to release is a discussion about The Exorcist and about how the scariest parts of that for me is the medical stuff.
Absolutely.
And so this was this thing where I was like, oh no, I just got done editing that episode, and now I gotta watch another, I gotta watch another part where the medical field is used as villain or used as a weapon or what have you.
Which, speaking of killing of a sacred deer, that's basically part of the thesis. But I love that the film, there's a part of me that appreciates that the film feels like it slows down significantly once you get to the forest,
right?
Because you feel this slow, like almost horrible disappointment come upon you as the film's like pacing slows down. And it really relates to the way that, you know, once they blind her, this slow, horrible, crushing disappointment of, oh, we're not gonna work, kind of pops in, and it's like, oh, this is awful. Which of course ends with Colin Farrell saying, oh, I'll blind myself to make this work, but he almost leaves it ambiguous. Personally, I like to take the funny route in that Colin Farrell just leaves her there, which is just, it's a messed up funny route.
Well, I would think that the messed up funny route would be that he does kill him, or he doesn't kill himself, but he does wound himself, but he just can't find his way back to her.
He just doesn't know how to get back there.
He's just stumbling around somewhere, you know, he doesn't know how to get back there.
It's like John C. Reilly accidentally getting shot by his own gun in the forest.
Yep, exactly. That's exactly right.
I do want to mention like a big thing. I mentioned in the Dogtooth that Lanthimos likes to obscure violent power structures when they're on screen.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Which is basically that whenever we're talking about Dogtooth and the Lobster, that's basically a take a shot game. Every single time he obscures a violent power structure on screen, take a shot. Because whenever Colin Farrell comes into the place, you know, the woman interviewing him, you can't see her. He shows a little bit more whenever they have the shoes. But Michael Smiley, whenever they're sitting in the parents' apartment. He's mm-hmm. out of focus. He is just pushed way back into the frame. And I'm like, man, I'm really enjoying putting together these different visual motifs that Lanthimos is going to continue to use, though I think it'll become a talking point in The Killing of a Sacred Deer and The Favorite, that because those films are within the perspective of those violent power structures, he has a lot more fun just dunking on them and showing you them suffer. Mm-hmm. which is, yeah, I mean, that's kind of why I enjoy Sacred Deer the most. It's just, it's the funniest of them.
Sure, yeah, absolutely.
Which, absolutely, that probably makes me sound rather sick. The movie where the kid gets shot is the funniest movie of all of these.
You know,
well, I'm not sick. Lanthimos is sick.
Absolutely. Don't blame me. Yeah. Hey, this was, you know, Colin Farrell was nominated for The Lobster for best actor in a comedy. So, you know, they're comedies, guys.
The Lobster is funny. Yeah. It is very, very funny. Yeah, I mean, yeah, these are just great films, and I'm glad that I grew up in a time whenever these could be kind of the defining films of like me getting into filmmaking and me getting into movies.
Yeah, absolutely.
I just remember the excitement that surrounded The Lobster, you know, coming out of Cannes for me and wanting to get the poster, but somebody else had gotten it. And I was like, shoot. and it really expanded even more with Sacred Deer. Cause I was at a critic screening for that one, but I'll talk about that on the Sacred Deer episode.
Gotcha. Yeah. One of the things that they do that's that I appreciate is the actual graphic design of the different posters. Yeah.
Yeah. Lanthimos has basically the best posters, and they look very similar. Mm-hmm. But the graphic design on The Lobster poster is beautiful. You know, mm-hmm. these silhouettes of the people hugging someone that is not there.
Mm-hmm. And what I like about it too is that it looks like it could be a screenshot too, because it's throughout whenever he does have the opportunity to hug someone, this is the way that he sort of hugs them. Like his hands are always a little bit disconnected to where it's not like a full embrace. And so I don't know. I really appreciate that one. I think that's a lot better than the Blu-ray one that was released.
Where it's a collection
of their headshots.
Well, I mean, we could probably host an episode of the show about Blu-ray covers.
It's probably
true. Have you seen the Little Women Blu-ray cover?
Ooh, you know what? I don't know that I have.
We need to go fight some graphic designer.
I did used to teach a little bit of that, and I do have some good friends that are graphic designers. It's not the one that's here on IMDb where it's just all of them in profile?
No. You got look it up on like Amazon.
Okay. Picture. I'll look it up on Blu-ray real quick.
Horrible.
Little Women.
Not to necessarily dunk on the person who graphic designed it. It's probably like, you know, a studio thing where lots of notes were given and stuff like
that. It's just Saoirse Ronan and straight ahead. And that's
yes.
What the hell is that about? Wow.
It's like, wait. But it's about Little Women.
Plural. It's plural, guys. It's not Little Woman.
Dogtooth has a wonderful minimalist poster.
Oh, yes.
The graphic design of the one tooth going in and the one tooth going out.
Absolutely. Yeah, if that isn't so symbolic scary of what you're going to get, yeah.
But it's really symbolic of this, the kind of the aesthetic of the new Greek wave. I think that's important to bring up, like Attenborough and this really wonderful film. I'm trying to remember the name of this. There, I saw this wonderful Greek new wave film. And they really, they seem to be defined by this, this coldness. That is also really funny.
Well, so it's different than the sort of German Hanukkah sort of deal. Because you mentioned Michael Haneke earlier.
Haneke's maybe not as funny as these guys. That being said, I did tend to find I did find Happy End quite funny, honestly.
You know, I haven't caught up to that. I watched I think I've only seen Funny People, or not, what's it, Funny Games, and Cachet, and a few other of the Haneke films are the only ones that I've seen.
Actually, I would say Lanthimos reminds me generally of Haneke. He is, I think, as his career goes on, he is migrating further away from these some of the weirder aspects of his work. Like, again, I think Sacred Deer has a lot more closure than either The Lobster or Dogtooth give you. Mm-hmm. And The Favorite is, The Favorite was an Oscar picture. It was certainly a bit of a weirder Oscar picture, but it was dressed up a bit more like an Oscar picture. Now, that being said, if you've seen the description of his next film, I'm looking forward to him kind of going back to this.
Yeah, going back to basics for sure.
Bet I can't make this work. Just bet.
Yeah, really.
Bet.
it does feel like a producer bet. Like, come up with something crazy.
Oftentimes his films do feel a bit like, yeah, I bet you that you're gonna believe that this isn't gonna work. Mm-hmm. But and then he just knocks it out of the park. And it feels like a magic trick, which a lot of great, I love movies that feel like magic tricks where this shouldn't work.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it does. And because Lanthimos has influenced my work itself, it's really hard to pull that off, actually. Like, I've tried.
Yeah, and it's hard to make it look so easy, right?
It's so difficult. But just mentioning, it looks like we've run up around 8:30. So I just want to, I want to make sure that we're not going overboard here.
No, that's fine. What else about Lobster? We didn't mention the music yet. What about the music here? Oh, we did, I guess. You mentioned the opening, or that song during the montage.
Yes.
But this is one where it feels like he's leaning in a little bit more into the music. And I didn't know if that's because of, it's more of a quote unquote traditional film than Dogtooth, because of it being in English and it being more of like it's still an odd film, but it's more of like, you know, you're using known actors, and so you got to give them a little bit more of what they expect or what they can handle, kind of a piece. Or I didn't know what that meant.
I think it's mainly that. Well, I mean, he talks about it in an interview. And Lanthimos, he seems really, as a person, he seems kind of introverted and really shy. And he's very blatant about, like, why, and very dry about, like, what his creative process is. And it mainly comes down to, he says, I just didn't really feel comfortable putting music in my films until more recently. And I think he's just getting a greater comfort in using music as a cinematic tool. The music in The Lobster is still pretty sparse. We're definitely moving into like these harsh strings territory that's really going to define Sacred Deer. But I also think, you know, you can tie it back to Alps or Dogtooth in his use of pop music as this like absurdist, you know, thing. It brings all this, you know, the dancing by themselves in the woods.
Right.
Absurd image to the foreground. And I think that a lot of filmmakers who make films like Lanthimos, I've noticed they tend to find a lot of absurdity in pop music. Specifically, I would talk about Brady Corbet. I think he was definitely influenced by Haneke, but Brady Corbet makes films a lot like Lanthimos's. You know, specifically, I'm talking about Vox Lux, which borrows Raffi Cassidy from Sacred Deer, and that movie is just a treatise on how pop music and just the industry around it. You know, it's both the most affirming thing in the world, and yet it is still an industry and extremely vapid. And I find it interesting the way that seems to be a very consistent theme within the work of filmmakers who make movies like this.
Absolutely.
Third, you know, these absurd fantasies of the modern world, you would call them, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah, I like that. I think that that's, you know, as sensible of an explanation as there could be, because, you know, I don't know that you always get a straightforward answer with Lanthimos. I feel like he's always holding something a little bit back, and maybe that is his introverted nature, or maybe it's just he's you know, isn't as candid as some filmmakers can be. But it's something that where I would love to listen to you know, some commentaries or something for him on his work, just to sort of digest all of what he was, oh well, we were thinking for this shot, or we were, you know, we were planning this and it turns out we actually did this, you know, those sorts of happy accidents and what have you.
I think, you know, I'm such a fan of the way that he withholds, because I guess I'm a big fan of movies that withhold to make you lean in.
Sure, yeah.
And, you know, I think Lanthimos's style of withholding could just make some people bounce off of his movies.
Well, yeah, I can think of a couple of women in the other room that would definitely feel that way for me.
But specifically for myself, his level of ambiguity and his withholding tends to make me lean in and think about what he's doing, rather than kind of be like, eh, that's stupid.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I don't think that, I don't know. I guess I feel like he's the sort of filmmaker that you're going to have at least a strong feeling for either way. Like, I don't know that, yes, you'll get a lot of like, I don't know, I didn't like it. You know, I feel like you're either going to be, what the hell was he doing? Why did they do this to the dog? Why did they do this to the cat? What is all this? Or you're really going to, you know, dig the fact that it's making you lean in a little bit more, and it's not necessarily making you work hard, because like I said, the, you know, the message is so clear, but it is doing it in a way that is a little bit, well, very different than a lot of other filmmakers do it.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, yeah. All right. Well, anything else before we wrap up this episode?
No, I can't think of anything else. It's just been really fun to talk about these movies, because I just love digging into movies that have this much to dig into.
Yeah, that has this sort of the fertile ground, so to speak, that you can,
yes,
you can bury yourself like Colin Farrell.
So, right.
That's right. So wrapping us up, if you have any comments, suggestions, or movies that you'd like to hear us talk about, you can email us at plainlabelpodcast@gmail.com. You can follow the show over at Twitter. Our handle is @plainlabelpod, where you can follow me. I'm @ericwilliams79. We also have an Instagram account. Just search for Plain Label Podcast and you'll find us over there. If you wanted to help out the show a little bit, you could check out our show notes, where you'll find the link to our Amazon wish list. And we have a whole bunch of stuff over there that I would like to have, but I don't necessarily want to buy. So you could get that for me if you really wanted to. I do want to thank Stephen for coming on. If people wanted to hear more from you or get in touch with you, where could they do that?
Well, I want to thank you for having me, because I just love opportunities like this. And honestly, I just get a lot of joy out of talking to people about movies. It's a great time. But if you want to reach me, you can find me, and you can find most of my information on at Twitter, at S, it's going to be, the handle is going to be at STRONICEK, or just look up Stephen with a PH, TRONICEK. That's pretty much the best way to get in contact with me at the moment. If you want to see more of my work, wearemoviegeeks.com. I write reviews for them, and I write pieces for them. That's pretty much it.
Wonderful, wonderful. Well, I do want to thank Stephen for coming on, and you can listen to us next week as we discuss Yorgos Lanthimos's most recent films, The Killing of a Sacred Deer and The Favorite. Thank you.
γνώσεις με ρωτάς ένα πρωί. Στην κουβέντα μας απάνω τι είναι άραγη ζωή. Τότε γύρισα και σου είπα για άλλους είναι το κρασί, για άλλους δόξα, για άλλους πλούτη, μα για μένα είσαι εσύ. Για άλλους δόξα, για άλλους πλούτη, μα για μένα είσαι εσύ. Που άλλαξε η καρδιά σου κι έναν άλλο αγαπά. Απορείς μου λένε ακόμα η δική μου πως χτυπά. Μήπως τα χάσαν και εμένα, δεν είναι άνθρωποι πολλοί. Από μέσα πεθαμένοι και από έξω ζωντανοί. Από μέσα πεθαμένοι και από έξω ζωντανή.